And I knew it wasn't something that happened just so I'd feel good for a period of time, but it was something to be shared with other people.
So that was Bill Pelkey on Democracy Now! With you in 2013. In fact, he was able to help get Paula Cooper off of death row, although she would ultimately take her own life. Your final thoughts in this last 20 seconds, Sister Helen Prejean.
Bill Pelkey is one more example of someone who, instead of being dehumanized by violence that happened to his beloved grandmother, took that courage that she had and brought it into life, and he fought for it his whole life to end the death penalty. He was the one waiting for Paula Cooper when she was released from prison, and it played such a role because he believed in life and that all human beings could be redeemed.
Sister Helen Prejean, I thank you so much for being with us, one of the world's most well-known anti-death penalty activists. And as we end today's show, a very happy birthday to Dina Guzder. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Felsmeyer-Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, and Adriana Contreras. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
The Homelessness Marathon is America's only national radio broadcast focusing on homelessness and poverty. The Homelessness Marathon will air on Wednesday, December 9th.
I wish they would do something about getting people off the streets.
I'm not giving up, and I don't want nobody to feel sorry for me.
The 22nd Annual Homelessness Marathon will air on Wednesday, December 9th, right here on this radio station.
Are you still looking for a way to fit KBOO into your year-end giving? KBOO is in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. For the last 14 years, Give Guide has raised over $28 million for hundreds of local nonprofits. Support KBOO and learn more about Give Guide by going to kboo.fm/give. Remember, we have a one-to-one match for all new and increasing donations too. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the man who shot and killed black teen Aiden Ellison in Ashland pleads not guilty to four charges. Oregon reported a record number of 1,669 COVID-19 cases on Saturday, and Moderna submits their COVID-19 vaccine for FDA approval. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 30th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. The man who shot and killed a 19-year-old black man in Ashland on November 23rd pleaded not guilty to four charges on Friday. The victim was 19-year-old Aiden Ellison, who was sitting in a car outside an Ashland hotel when 47-year-old Robert Keegan approached him. Keegan demanded that Ellison turn down the music he was listening to, and when he did not immediately comply, he shot Ellison in the chest. Ellison died at the scene. Keegan has been charged with second-degree murder, first-degree manslaughter, reckless endangerment, and unlawful possession of a weapon. He pleaded not guilty to all four charges. His next court date is February 21st. Media coverage immediately following the fatal shooting has been criticized for highlighting how Keegan was displaced due to the Almeda fire and that he was staying at the hotel with his 3-year-old son. Precious Edmonds is a spokesperson for the Southern Oregon Black Leaders, Activists, and Community Coalition, also known as So Black. She told Oregon Live, quote, "The incident where Aiden was shot after an argument listening to his music was really about him not submitting to that man's authority." Edmonds continued, quote, "He was listening to his music too loudly. That's irrelevant. It doesn't change a thing how good the man was who shot him. All of those things are not relevant to what occurred, but that's the narrative. That's the frame of white supremacy." A vigil was held to honor Ellison on Thursday, and Southern Oregon activists are planning a rally on December 2nd in front of the Jackson County Courthouse in his honor. The pharmaceutical company Moderna says it will submit its coronavirus vaccine for regulatory approval today. The biotech firm said it will ask the Food and Drug Administration for emergency use authorization after completing its Phase 3 trial. The company recently announced its vaccine was 94.1% effective against COVID-19 and 100% effective at preventing severe cases of the disease. The results were the same across all age, race, and gender categories, and so far there have been no serious safety concerns. The most common side effects have been fatigue, headaches, and muscle and joint pain. Moderna says it expects the FDA's Vaccine and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee to convene on December 17th to discuss its submission. That's 1 week after the FDA is expected to discuss another candidate developed by U.S. pharma giant Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech. They recently also applied for regulatory approval. Both the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines use messenger RNA to trick the body into developing an immune response against the virus. These would be the first messenger RNA-based vaccines to be given approval. If the FDA grants the vaccines emergency use authorization, and it's expected that they will, rolling out the shots will be an immense supply chain challenge, and it will be taking place at a scale that has never been attempted before. Moderna said on Monday that it expects to have about 20 million doses of its vaccine available in the U.S. by the end of 2020 and is on track to manufacture between 500 million and 1 billion doses globally next year. According to Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, the first vaccinations in the U.S. are expected to take place in late December, with healthcare workers and nursing home residents receiving priority. Over the weekend, the Oregon Health Authority reported 3,268 new cases of COVID-19, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 74,120. On Saturday, the state reported a record number of 1,669 new cases. Multnomah County alone reported 648 new cases on Sunday, followed by Washington County with 206, Clackamas County with 136, and Marion County with 126 cases. Oregon health officials also reported 20 new deaths over the weekend, raising the state's death toll to 905 people. In a press release, the Oregon Health Authority said surpassing 900 deaths was a, quote, somber milestone. The statewide freeze announced by Governor Kate Brown expires this Wednesday, and a new set of restrictions for the state are set to take effect on Thursday. The new rules are implemented on a county-by-county basis, with 21 counties in the state being labeled as extreme risk. They'll have the most stringent restrictions. This includes Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties. Under the framework, counties in the extreme risk category should limit social gatherings to a maximum of 6 people from 2 households, restrict restaurants and bars to outdoor dining with takeout strongly encouraged, prohibit indoor recreation and entertainment, including gyms, cap retail capacity at 50%, and faith institutions at 25% or 100 people, whichever is less. Outdoor recreation is allowed with a maximum capacity of 50 people, and personal services such as barbers and hair salons can remain open. In addition, long-term care facilities can allow limited outdoor visitation. Nationally, as of Monday afternoon, more than 13.5 million people in the U.S. have been infected with COVID-19. At least 267,000 people have died across the country. Case numbers are spiking across most of the U.S., leading to warnings about full hospitals, exhausted healthcare workers, and expanding lockdowns. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 63 million people in nearly every country. At least 1.4 million people have died across the world. Exports of timber from Oregon to China this year could be a tenth of what they have been in the past due to an ongoing trade war and the COVID-19 pandemic. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
The timber industry in Oregon and across the country is battered from an unresolved trade war with China and the COVID-19 pandemic. Andrew Mohammed is a professor at the University of Tennessee who formerly worked in the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Economic Resource Service on international trade issues. He says the U.S. provides raw timber materials to China and then buys back the finished products. But tariffs caused Oregon exports to China to drop 70% between 2017 and 2019. With an additional decrease in demand due to COVID-19, Mohammed says the state's connection to China is suffering.
A state that once exported, say, $100 million in logs and lumber and other forest products to China looks like it's on record to be in less than $10 million this year.
Imports of wood furniture and other products to the U.S. from China were down 40% as of August. Mohammed says an already vulnerable industry has taken a massive hit this year. He also notes that the losses have a ripple effect on communities.
You have all these associated and related activities, such as the income from laborers and how they spend that moving forward, trucking activities, other related value-added activities that take place. That too gets diminished by this decrease exported.
Mohammed says some parts of the timber industry are doing okay during the pandemic, such as the home lumber market, because more people are staying in their houses. But he says it would be preferable to have a wholly viable industry, especially for communities in states such as Oregon.
Even if other aspects of the sector seems to be sort of thriving, if not just surviving throughout this COVID-19 pandemic period, certainly the decline in exports has been felt by particular producers, and it would be good if that could get resolved.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Washington state lawmakers convene in January and will have to deal with a massive hole in the budget. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Washington state workers say potential budget cuts will hurt Washingtonians. Because of the pandemic, the state is facing a $3.3 billion shortfall through 2023. Agencies like the Department of Social and Health Services have been asked to determine what a 15% cut would look like. Constantine Ungurian is a spoken language interpreter who contracts with state agencies. He helps folks access health care and is especially worried about a lack of interpreters during the pandemic.
Without access to interpreters, the most vulnerable will be denied access to public services and also to health care and life-saving medical treatment. So it is a very big concern on my mind right now.
Ungurian believes lawmakers should look elsewhere for revenue, including fixing the state's regressive tax system, in which low- and middle-income Washingtonians pay a far greater percentage of their wages in taxes than do high-income residents. Larry Nelson works in Spokane for DSHS's Adult Protective Services, investigating crimes such as financial exploitation of older Washingtonians. He's concerned cuts will lead to fewer investigators and more crime against vulnerable Washingtonians. Nelson believes this work is his calling, considering himself like a sheepdog protecting the flock.
The job that I'm in right now gives me a greater sense of satisfaction in that I'm able to advocate and help protect those who have difficulty protecting themselves.
Matthew Cox is a transportation systems technician in Wenatchee, ensuring that highways are safe to drive through functioning traffic signs and signals. His work is critical in natural disasters such as avalanches that block the highway. He says many people may not know that he and his colleagues are first responders.
We're the ones who are operating the shift to keep the highway lanes open. I'm concerned because budgetary cuts, if that comes to start cutting jobs or we have to start laying people off, then we're not going to be able to provide the service to the highway that the public has come to depend on and require.
The 2021 legislative session convenes on January 11th. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
President Trump will continue his spree of federal executions into the last week of his presidency. Five additional federal executions are scheduled between now and January 20th, making Trump's lame duck period a historically deadly one. If all scheduled executions take place, the Trump administration will set a record for the most executions in a single year. It will also set a handful of other grim precedents. Two men scheduled for execution, Corey Johnson and Alfred Bourgeois, are reportedly intellectually disabled. A 2002 Supreme Court case ruled that subjecting intellectually disabled people to the death penalty violated federal protections against cruel and unusual punishment, yet both prisoners have been unable to properly appeal their sentence. This year we'll also see the first federal execution of a woman in nearly 70 years. Lisa Montgomery is currently the only woman on the federal death row. Her execution has been pushed back to January due to a coronavirus diagnosis among her legal team. Federal executions began this July for the first time in 17 years. Since then, 8 people have been executed, with another 5 scheduled to die by the end of January. Last week, President Trump made a rules change to expand legal methods of execution to include firing squads and electrocution in the absence of lethal injection drugs. The United States is the only Western democracy practicing capital punishment. President-elect Joe Biden expressed interest in putting an end to the death penalty at the federal level in favor of lifetime sentences. On top of the ethical and legal issues surrounding these scheduled executions, civil rights advocates worry they could become super-spreader events at the federal facility in Indiana where they are scheduled to occur. According to data obtained by the ACLU, the last round of executions in July and August caused a major outbreak at the facility. Now, with the virus raging throughout the country, ACLU officials call the move to fast-track 5 executions, quote, absolutely unconscionable. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 5:30 for Coast Range Radio, where hosts will be speaking with the director of the Oregon Ocean Science Trust about Oregon fisheries, the importance they have to local communities, and opportunities for conservation. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, we'll hear Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, stick around for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 37 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy as well with a high of 49. Today in history, in 1874, Winston Churchill is born in Oxfordshire, England. Churchill would go on to be a leader who guided Great Britain and the Allies through the crisis of World War II. The quote of the day is from former UK Prime Minister Winston Churchill, who said, quote, "Politics is more dangerous than war, for in war you are only killed once." How likely is it that Trump will face jail time after he's out of office? And updates on state voter certifications. With more on both of those stories, it's Laura Rosbrough Tellum with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
I have a couple of items for all of you at the top.
Jennifer Psaki, veteran Democratic spokeswoman, is President-elect Joe Biden's newly named White House press secretary. She's part of what will be the nation's first all-women-led presidential communications team. More cabinet nominees are expected this week, and more pardons from President Donald Trump. His 28th, announced just before Thanksgiving, Michael T. Flynn, Trump's former national security advisor, is one of the 7 people who pled guilty or were convicted resulting from the Robert Mueller investigation, looking into Russian interference with the 2016 election. Many observers say Flynn's pardon does not conform with legal norms. But former federal prosecutor Shen Wu has a theory about Trump's action.
The reason Flynn seems valuable to pardon is there's an aspect of him feeling like he's trying to really close the door on the whole Mueller investigation.
So far, Trump has granted clemency to 45 people, including former campaign manager Roger Stone, convicted of obstructing justice also in conjunction with the Mueller probe. The investigation surfaced 37 indictments and 14 criminal matters referred to other components of the Justice Department. Based on the findings, 1,000 former federal prosecutors also publicly concluded that President Trump would have been indicted on multiple counts of obstructing justice had he been just a citizen. Wu believes the Russia-related cases are the least likely to incriminate Trump.
I think the bank fraud, tax fraud cases present the most jeopardy to him because of the amounts of money at issue.
Wu's talking about what Trump's facing in New York. Even if Trump tries to pardon himself, his executive clemency is for federal crimes. If there's financial fraud, Wu says the likelihood Trump will face time behind bars is quite real. While sentencing guidelines allow judges discretion, there's a formula.
They're very mathematical, and when the loss amount or the amount of fraud gets over X amount of money, there has to be some kind of jail time.
This weekend, Pennsylvania's high court threw out another challenge filed by state Republicans, allowing the state to complete its certification of the presidential vote won by Biden. So far, all Republican lawsuits alleging problems with the election have been withdrawn or dismissed. Today, while Arizona officials are expected to certify its vote, Trump's lawyers and some state legislators plan a gathering in Phoenix to continue disputing the results. Wisconsin's certification deadline is tomorrow. Their just-finished recount showed Biden still ahead by more than 20,000 votes. The Trump campaign continues efforts to disqualify more than 200,000 Wisconsin absentee ballots. The only major elections left are the two Georgia Senate runoff races on January 5th. On Thanksgiving, Trump announced that he'll visit there this weekend.
Going back to Georgia just for a second, so I'll be going there on Saturday night, and maybe I'll go twice. It's very important that we win those races. These are two great people.
The outcome will decide which party controls the Senate. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum. Thanks for listening.
A Navajo doctor is named to President-elect Joe Biden's COVID-19 advisory board, and critics say a new TV show set in Montana overlooks the real crisis. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Navajo Department of Health Executive Director Dr. Jill Jim has been selected to serve on the Biden-Harris COVID-19 Advisory Board, according to the Navajo Nation. The board will help advise the next presidential administration on the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Jim has been leading the Navajo Health Department since January and has been helping the tribe with COVID-19 measures. In a statement, Dr. Jim said she looks forward to working with other members on the advisory board to help prepare an urgent response to the global public health crisis for President-elect Biden. Her selection comes as the tribe is seeing a surge of COVID-19 cases. The Navajo Nation is currently under a 3-week stay-at-home lockdown to address the increase of cases. As of Sunday, the number of positive COVID-19 cases for the Navajo Nation reached more than 16,000. Bristol Bay tribes in Alaska are calling for permanent protection of the Bristol Bay watershed after a permit for a proposed copper and gold mine was denied. The tribe celebrated news the Army Corps of Engineers denied a permit for the Pebble Mine. The tribes are seeking permanent protection for the region, concerned about threats of mining to the environment, fish, and their cultures. The Pebble Partnership, in a statement, expressed dismay as it sorts out next steps, including an appeal. The new television show Big Sky is facing backlash from critics who say ABC overlooked an opportunity to talk about a real crisis in Montana. Yellowstone Public Radio's Caitlin Nicholas has more.
ABC's new procedural drama, Big Sky, based on Wyoming author C.J. Box's novel The Highway and adapted by the screenwriter of Big Little Lies, follows the disappearance of two women near Yellowstone National Park.
Lock the doors.
What? We're fine.
Both women are white. In a state where 26% of all missing persons are Native American, Indigenous critics say it's a misstep to ignore the actual crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous persons in Montana. Barbara Bassett, a Chippewa Cree tribal member and a Great Falls state representative, decided to live tweet the recent premiere.
No representation of one Native person through the entire episode.
After the premiere, the Rocky Mountain Tribal Leaders Council, along with other Native American groups, sent a letter to ABC executives critiquing the show and asking producers to direct their national audience toward information on missing and murdered Indigenous women after each episode. ABC did not respond to interview requests in time for broadcast and hasn't publicly responded. Some critics say they're relieved Natives aren't referenced in the show because none of Big Sky's writers are Indigenous. Bassett says this is part of the problem.
They missed an amazing opportunity to not only find Indigenous writers and Indigenous actors who are already underrepresented. They could have brought MMIW to national attention as well.
Ivan McDonald, a Blackfeet Nation member and filmmaker, says national attention by mainstream media can bolster interest and important funding for MMIW activism. He says Wind River, a 2017 film about the murder of a Native woman in Wyoming, drew important national attention to MMIW issues.
I think particularly at this kind of time in history is really when the film industry and media industry should really be investing. If we're going to be telling Indigenous stories, you know, some of the most neglected stories in the country, even though they're the longest stories here.
With critical reviews from the likes of Rolling Stone calling Big Sky exploitative and disappointing, McDonald says there are plenty of great films to be watching instead. Throughout this month, the Smithsonian is streaming their Native Cinema Showcase. All Nations Health Center in Missoula is streaming the 4th annual Indigenous Film Festival. State lawmaker Bassett says representation is important because it helps people reimagine what they can do with their lives.
So when you're reflected, when you see those things in pop culture, in politics, you feel empowered and you know that that is something that is open to you.
That was Caitlin Nicholas reporting, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
As sea levels rise, flooding in Norfolk, Virginia has become a chronic problem. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Norfolk, Virginia is home to the largest naval base in the world. The city is also on the front lines of sea level rise. During high tides, water covers many roads.
The arteries that go in and out of the naval base, those roads are now becoming flooded on a more regular basis. It's becoming a chronic problem.
That's Norfolk City Council member Andrea McClellan. She says the frequent flooding does not just impede traffic to the naval base. It disrupts residents' lives.
The road that I travel to get to and from City Hall is flooded several times a month now. I have to take a different route. It'll be sunny outside, and truly, the road's impassable.
On top of sea level rise, storms are pouring more rain on the region. When storms hit, many residents worry about flooding in their homes.
When you add the two together, it's really, truly the perfect storm. But it's the biggest issue facing our city and our region.
But McClellan says that adapting to more water will require massive and expensive infrastructure updates.
And as a city, we simply just don't have the funding to tackle anything of that scale. So we're looking for the private sector, we're looking for government, we're looking for NGOs, we're looking under every rock to find funding to help us with the solutions.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
The French government has agreed to overhaul a controversial police law after 2 days of protests across the country. The law in question is Article 24. It's part of a new global security bill currently making its way through France's parliament. The law would make it a crime to film or share footage of police, quote, with the aim of damaging their physical or psychological integrity. Critics of the law include civil rights groups and journalists. They worry that the new security law would impede press freedom and decrease police accountability. Both the European Union and the United Nations have warned French lawmakers that any legislation must follow international human rights laws and not interfere with press freedom. Officials proposing the bill say they want to protect police from online threats and harassment. Just as the security bill was passing the lower house of parliament last week, two separate videos of police violence went viral, sparking outrage and nationwide protests. The first video was released last Monday. It showed police brutally clearing a migrant camp in Paris using tear gas and clubs. The second video came from CCTV footage and showed four police officers beating a black man named Michel Zeckler without provocation. Critics of police violence wonder whether either of these videos would make it to the surface once Article 24 is set into law. Demonstrations against the new law and police brutality took place nationwide in France over the weekend. In a news conference earlier today, parliamentary leaders announced they would be completely rewriting Article 24 to ensure that it can't be used to abuse press freedoms. Protesters are calling for the article to be scrapped entirely, saying it contradicts, quote, the fundamental public freedoms of our republic. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 30th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Samantha Law, the producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Laura Rossbrow-Tellum, Eric Tegadoff, and Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, Alternative Radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's a 2020 Giving Tuesday special, Giving Back to PDX. KBOO is grateful to be a part of Willamette Week's Give Guide for the fifth year in a row. Station co-manager Celeste Carey will speak with other Portland area nonprofits featured in this year's Give Guide to learn about their work and impact. At 11, it's Stage and Studio. Host D-May Roberts spotlights Portland-based actor and singer Alec Cameron Lugo. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus, featuring interviews with artists, curators, and critics talking about art, how it's made, and what it means. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app to click on donate. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio, focusing on Oregon's fisheries.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Everybody, thanks for tuning in to Coast Range Radio, a radio program of the Coast Range Association. My name is Andrew. You can reach me at andrew@coastrange.org. To hear past episodes of Coast Range Radio, you can visit coastrange.org/coastrangeradio. You can also download and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We want to thank all the community radio stations who air Coast Range Radio. If you are listening now on the radio, please take a moment to support your local station for the important service that they provide. In today's episode, I'm speaking with Laura Anderson, owner of Local Ocean, a seafood restaurant in Newport, Oregon. Laura brings a wealth of knowledge and experience to our conversation about Oregon's fisheries. We discuss Oregon's different fisheries, their conservation and economic concerns, and opportunities, along with climate change impacts to Oregon's fisheries. Hey everyone, thank you for tuning in. This is Coast Range Radio, radio program of the Coast Range Association, and I'm really excited. Today we are speaking with owner of Local Ocean Dockside Grill and Fish Market, Laura Anderson, based in Newport, Oregon. Hey Laura, thank you so much for joining us on Coast Range Radio.
Hi Andrew, good to be here.
Great. Laura has a master's degree in marine resource management from Oregon State University, and she brings that understanding of the science and policy to her work as the owner of Local Ocean. She also is the director of the Oregon Ocean Science Trust and a board member of the Oregon Coast Aquarium and a trustee of the Nature Conservancy of Oregon. Laura, thank you so much for your work on Oregon's coast, Oregon's fisheries. And get our listeners a sense of your work and who you are, what got you into and passionate about seafood and the Oregon's coast and Oregon's marine environments?
Yeah, sure, Andrew. Well, I guess you could say I was born into it. My father was a commercial fisherman. We were originally from Westport, Washington, and I had fished with my dad as a teenager, several summers plying the Oregon and California coast for king salmon. That was our main fishery. I also Dungeness crab fished with him. And we came to Oregon when I was a teenager and came here for better fishing opportunity and put my roots down here and was really happy to come back and open the restaurant, which was about 15 years ago now.
Great. And for listeners, what is Local Ocean, your restaurant there?
Yeah, so Local Ocean Seafoods is a very seafood-centric, local-centric restaurant here in Newport. We also have a fish market. And for the last 15 years, that's been really our main game, is serving people Our mission is to feed people the best seafood experience of their lives. And we do that through fish and chips, fish tacos, fishwife stews, smoked black cod, all of our favorite things. Of course, when the pandemic came in March, we weren't able to serve in that traditional way. And now we have Dock Box by Local Ocean, which is a make it home meal kit that we deliver to several markets throughout Oregon, including Portland, Corvallis, and soon to be Bend. Our first Bend box is going to be delivered November 13th.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, I'm pretty familiar with the CSA model. That's a great, and I know that that's really thriving right now with local farms. So that's really cool to see that that's been an avenue during this intense upheaval with COVID-19. I hope that's been very successful for you all. You brought up some of those different fish that you offer in your box and in the food that you serve. And when we were preparing for this interview, you brought up some of really interesting information that I didn't know, and I thought would be really interesting for folks to learn about is the, you know, I don't know if a lot of people know what the big fisheries are in Oregon and maybe their status and some interesting information on those fisheries. So what are the big fisheries in Oregon?
Sure. Well, if you took the economic pie of Oregon fisheries, generally about a third of it would be attributed to Dungeness crab. We consider it kind of the backbone of Oregon fisheries because so many fishermen participate in it, probably at least 350 boats of all sizes, very small boats that work out of, for example, Port Orford, where boats are under 33 feet, to some of our largest vessels in our fleet that can be over 70, 80 feet. So it's really important for kind of meeting all the different size businesses that are the fishing businesses that make up our diverse fleet. And about a third of it would be attributed to the pink shrimp fishery, which is really cool. Oregon's pink shrimp fishery is one of the first to be certified sustainable in the world, due in part to some of the cool gear innovations, including fish excluder devices, where fish can swim right out of the net and it will still catch shrimp, and also ways that they've used underwater lights to avert smelt species. So lots of cool innovations in that fishery that make it one of our favorites. We also have about a third of our fisheries to groundfish, which is a big complex. Most of your whitefish fall into groundfish, so halibut, lingcod, rockfish, black cod. And then to a smaller extent, we have albacore tuna and king salmon are both economically important here as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you were bringing up, you know, pink shrimp fishery and some innovations there. What are some concerns or different issues with these different fisheries as far as, you know, sustainability, conservation? Is there something that stands out to you of, you know, a success? What are some areas of concern?
Yeah. Well, usually when we're looking at the ecological sustainability of a fishery, there's three things that are of primary concern. One is the population stable? So where we have good stock assessment data, we can use that to say whether or not the population is stable. Sometimes we don't have stock assessments. We use other catch per unit effort as a metric that can be used, or just managing the fishery. For example, the crab fishery doesn't have a stock assessment, but because it's only retaining mature males and returning all of the juvenile males and females to the ocean, it ensures that that fishery comes back every year. So we just want to make sure the populations are stable. For all of our Oregon fisheries, we're on good trajectories, all of the fisheries that I mentioned. For that, even the salmon fishery, which it was decimated traditionally in our Pacific Northwest area from a whole host of factors due to things, both fishing included and outside of fishing, even that fishery is managed for sustainable specific runs and populations and avoiding runs and populations that have any particular problems. The second thing that we look at is habitat. Does the fishery interact with the habitat in a way that might be damaging? Surely there's been a history of some damaging gears that were used in the kind of the traditional ways of fishing, but a lot of that has been changed now. Gear is much lighter and has a much lower impact on bottom habitat. Trawling, for example, has a much lighter footprint, and actually large areas of the Oregon coast are closed to trawling for rockfish conservation. So we have some pretty good feel-good stories there. And then the third thing that we look at is the fishery selective? Is it catching what it's trying to catch and not impacting other species adversely? So a great example of this is the albacore tuna fishery, where you have your hooks out on the surface of the water and you're catching these fish hook and line one at a time. They tend to swim in big schools, and so they don't really cavort with other fishes. So that's a great example of a very targeted fishery. So those are the three things that we usually look at from a biological and ecological standpoint.
Great. Yeah, that's some really excellent information. Some things I didn't know about there. So we've got the biological, ecological standpoint. How are the fishers doing? The folks who are out on the water, you know, economically, what's the impacts and what's happening there with the communities that, you know, rely and provide this resource for Oregonians?
Yeah, great question, Andrew, because sustainability is more than just the biology of the critter. We really, I think, moved maybe 20 years ago or so towards the three E's look at sustainability, which is environment, economy, and equity. So thinking about the economics of fisheries, it can be really hit and miss, honestly. In my lifetime, there's been a lot of changes in how markets have responded to our local fisheries. For example, when Local Ocean first started in 2004, there were boats tied up at the dock with holds full of albacore tuna that they wouldn't sell because the price was so low. At that point, I think buyers were offering somewhere around 30, 40 cents a pound for these fish, and fishermen let these fish rot before they would sell them. Now here today, 15 years later, this market is still really volatile. It can go up and down, but fish are generally fetching more in the $2 a pound range, which it's hard to do with tuna. Tuna is a global commodity. Albacore tuna that we catch are swimming through the waters of no less than 22 different countries. So we have to compete on a global scale for something like that, and it can make things difficult for those fishers. When it comes to other species like Dungeness crab, we've got really a good corner on that market. Oregon catches a large portion of the West Coast share, and so we're not in a global marketplace so much. But, you know, having a diversity of buyers, we have big buyers, we've got small buyers, and keeping markets open to a whole diversity of size buyers is something that's important for resiliency of the fisheries.
Yeah, and it seems like it's so important to be able to balance the populations, the biology with the what can be harvested. And sounds like, so Oregon regulates those? How is that regulated?
Yeah, some of our fisheries are managed by the state. Those are usually the ones that occur within 3 miles of shore. And some fisheries are managed by federal regulations, especially something that's gonna travel between different states and around the ocean. Some fisheries are on a quota basis. You can only catch so many as a whole group of people can catch so many fish, and then it's shut down. And some fisheries, each boat has their own individual quota. So there's a lot of different strategies out there for managing them. There's no one size fits all approach.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. One thing that we talk a lot about on Coast Range Radio and is, you know, on the top of our minds at the Coast Range Association is climate change and how communities are addressing climate change, how communities are adapting to it. Some kind of forward thinking on what's that impact on Oregon's coast in our fisheries. What is your sense of what's happening now with climate change? What are the future impacts, and what can we do as Oregonians and people who are, you know, passionate about these issues to address some of these concerns?
Yeah, boy, Andrew, it's such a big topic. From an ocean's perspective, what we see is the ocean acidification side of climate change. So as the oceans are absorbing more of the free carbon, it's increasing, or rather decreasing, the pH. We've already seen some stress to some of the shelled critters that have calcium shells, like oysters, have been fairly well studied. And it's definitely a concern for any of the crustacean species, but really it's the whole food web. Because the ocean, I mean, the cool thing about wild fisheries is that it's a naturally driven process. All it takes is sunlight to convert plankton, both phytoplankton and zooplankton, into food for the whole trophic chain that gets us to our edible species. So if that breaks down at the zooplankton level, then it's hard to say what could happen for species all the way up the chain, all the way to species that we don't consume, like whales and marine mammals. So as fishers, I think it's really at the forefront of the industry's minds on what to expect for the future. The other thing that we know about ocean acidification, or we think that we know about this, is that the carbon that sunk to the bottom of the ocean decades ago is going to get upwelled in the future. So even if we reach net neutrality today, which of course would not happen, but even if we did, we still know that we're going to have impacts coming up to the surface for decades to come. So we have to be prepared for that. And I don't think anybody has the right solutions on how to achieve that.
Yeah, it's such a big issue, ocean acidification. I've read or heard that Oregon is impacted, is kind of on the forefront of impacts from ocean acidification. With the oyster fisheries, they kind of caught it early, or at least noticed impacts, and they've been able to, or the oyster hatcheries, and have been able to kind of deal with those, you know, adding buffers into their tanks and stuff. But that's in a controlled hatchery situation or a farm situation. It's so much, it's a big impact on a coastal ocean wide scale. It is a really tricky one. And I know Oregon has a task force or a organizing body that is addressing some of these issues and trying to adapt. I forget the name of it off the top of my head.
Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia Task Force is, yeah, what you're referring to. And yeah, that was set up by the Oregon legislature, and they're very active in coming up with a strategic plan to guide state policy so that departments have guidance on how they can do their part. And really, it comes down to carbon sources and carbon sinks. So how do we reduce the sources of carbon into the environment, and how do we increase the sinks? So I think that group is just still putting together their final recommendations for the state on that.
Great. Yeah, that's something to for folks to stay tuned into and connected with. As the director of the Oregon Ocean Science Trust, could you describe what that work is that you do there and what that organization does?
Sure. The Ocean Science Trust was set up by the legislature to help the state meet the scientific priorities that it has for the nearshore area specifically. So one of the projects that we're working on right now is fundraising for a marine reserves assessment. The marine reserves were created about 10 years ago and have undergone a lot of monitoring work by the Department of Fish and Wildlife to assess whether or not they're meeting the goals that were set up for the marine reserves. And now the time has come to do an assessment. So one of the projects of the Oregon Ocean Science Trust is just to help coordinate that and to help fundraise for that process. But really the Science Trust is just a body that is here to help bring resources to the state for any of the nearshore science needs.
Great.
That it determines. Yeah.
What a great resource. You brought up the marine reserves. Coast Range Association has been engaged with marine reserve issues, the state's marine reserve program. I'm wondering, from your work at, you know, working with fishers and working in fisheries, I know that it's very early still in the marine reserves and that, you know, we're not necessarily seeing like huge like growth in fish populations or anything like that. That's not really the purpose of these at the moment. But what is your experience working with fishers and fisheries and the interactions with marine reserves?
Yeah, Andrew, the marine reserves for most of the fishermen that I've talked to have been a pretty tough nut to swallow. Any time that the access to a fishing area is reduced, it has an impact, an economic impact on individual fishermen and the fishing community as a whole. So, as you said, the purpose of the marine reserves was not to create more fish or to be a fisheries management tool. It was, I think, remains to be seen as the assessment will hopefully take place over the next couple of years as to if the marine reserves are meeting the goals that they were set out for. Fishermen had been supportive of science in terms of helping to understand fisheries, or actually rather ecosystems and fish populations better. So I think they see a benefit to having better science, but I don't know that the majority of them were convinced that marine reserves were a necessary tool to achieve that. While marine reserves had been used in tropical areas for a long time and had showed fishery both biomass and diversity benefits, it was unclear whether or not that would be replicated here in a temperate ecosystem. So I think this assessment is really important that we take the opportunity to have independent scientists look at the state's data, the synthesized data, and answer the questions of whether or not the marine reserves are being effective.
I would like for you, how can people, you know, learn about your work? How can folks find Local Ocean and support Oregon's fisheries?
Sure. Well, I mean, you can find Local Ocean on the web, of course, at localocean.net. And from there, we do takeout. We take reservations for dine-in. We have our dock box that can be ordered. Our fish market is open for people to come in and buy fish. So those are the main channels that we have to do what we do, which is feed people. We also have Facebook and Instagram. I like to talk about different things on social media. One of the things I'm really interested in now is some of the new health research that's coming out about the benefits of eating seafood. I just feel so blessed that we live here on the coast and have access to this incredible food resource. We have to eat, and we have choices in what we eat, but finding really high quality protein like we have with our Oregon seafood species is something that we can't take for granted. And especially now, the research about heart benefits and general health benefits with seafood have been around for decades, but right now people are really keyed in on immunity and building their immune system. And I'm really encouraged about the research with the vitamins, particularly vitamin D and omega-3s, and a lot of the minerals like zinc and iron and calcium and selenium that are in our seafood species like albacore tuna and king salmon, and how people are getting immune boosting benefits from it. And I was also really interested, more people are eating seafood at home now. As a result of the pandemic, seafood sales used to be about 2/3 in restaurants and about 1/3 in retail. And now retail is increased by 30% to 40% as people are eating at home. So they're ordering online or they're buying frozen seafood, taking it home, and finding that it's really something that the kids want to eat too. So as more kids are eating seafood, I was raised on eating seafood. Of course, you know, as the daughter of a commercial fisherman, we had lingcod and halibut, and you know, I had no idea when I was a kid how sought after and valuable this food was. I thought we were just eating poor kids' food, right? Because this was just stuff that my dad brought home. And it wasn't until I went to college that I realized how much people valued seafood. I'd be like, oh, mom, halibut again? Really? But I'm so glad that I ate all of that wonderful food, because now they show that child IQ development can benefit 7 to 8 points from fish consumption, which I think is just super cool and awesome. So it just makes me feel good about what we do, feeding people high quality food. And as long as we have the sun to shine to keep that primary production going in the ocean, it's really neat that even the conservation community, which maybe had been hard on wild capture fisheries traditionally, now sees wild capture fisheries as really one of the best protein production alternatives for feeding the planet. It doesn't take land. It doesn't take fresh water. It doesn't take chemicals. And it doesn't have a high carbon footprint. It's just a solar-generated food machine. And as long as we do our job with managing and harvesting sustainably, we're lucky that we've got it right out our back door here in Oregon.
That's great. Thank you so much, Laura. Really appreciate you taking the time for educating folks here on Coast Range Radio. We look forward to more conversations on these issues in the future.
Yeah, thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time.
listening to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO is excited to be part of the Willamette Week Give Guide this year. When you support KBOO through Give Guide, not only does it support your